Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. One guest this week, but an excellent one. Mary Ornsby is the author of World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. For those in the audience who don't know who Ben Johnson is, Google that name. 1988, Seoul Olympics, arguably the most famous 100-meter gold medal run in the Olympic Games because of what happened. Ben Johnson tests positive for steroids, eventually loses his gold medal, but should he have, is the real interesting question there. And Mary Ornsby, who worked at the Toronto Star for three decades as a sports writer and an investigative reporter, one of the great investigative reporters in Canadian sports history, went back. She reported on this at the time, went back and has a pretty extraordinary book that if you're into, certainly if you're into track and field or the Olympics, you should read. It's really revealing and interesting. So again, World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. Mary Ornsby is the guest coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right. As I said at the top, very excited to have this woman on. Again, for those of you in the American audience, you may not have heard of her, but if you lived in Canada, she's one of the more prominent writers in this country for many, many years. Mary Ornsby is the author of World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. She worked at the Toronto Star for three decades, where she was a longtime sports writer and one of the country's most acclaimed investigative reporters. She covered Ben Johnson when Ben Johnson became world news in Seoul and has stayed with the story now for quite some time and now has a book out on it. Again, the book is The World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. And with that, I bring in Mary Ornsby, welcome to the Sports Media Podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. All right. So, yeah, I should put my Peter Mansbridge voice on, Mary, and just very, very august acclaimed it. This is much more low budget and much less impressive than Mansbridge. So you have to roll with it.
You're on the Mansbridge podium. I can tell. That's a great voice.
Here's like really the obvious question, I think. Why did you want to do a book on Ben Johnson in 2024?
Well, part of it was over the decades since Seoul, Ben and I became, I work with him a bit more on things you would expect in a newspaper, the 10th anniversary of Seoul, the 20th anniversary of Seoul, all that stuff. And along the way, we began asking questions about, just what happened? Can you tell me a bit more? Because at the time, it was really much an open and shut case. You cheated, you sent home in disgrace. And on top of that, you were, outed as a longtime drug user. So, phooey on you. So right around that time, we began asking a bit more. And I was like, wow, I wonder if we had actually missed anything the first time around. And what really, really crystallized it for me was seeing that wonderful documentary, 979, by English filmmaker Dan Gordon. And in there, there were a couple of pieces of information, but Carl Lewis's manager, Joe Douglas, he admitted that they had, placed someone in the doping control room with Ben, the mystery man as we knew him at the time, just to keep an eye on Ben to make sure he hadn't done anything funny with his urine sample to try to mask anything he was doing because they suspected he was using steroids. And the other part of that documentary was, you know, when they asked the mystery man, who we became to know as Andre Jackson, you know, did you actually spike Ben's beer, as Ben claimed, you know, throw steroids in his suds, you know, and Andre Jackson responded in writing, well, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. So from there, I was like, oh, wow, I should probably go back and have a look at anything that is documented, exhibits, anything. So that was a long way of saying that really got my memory banks going and got me on that path.
What's interesting to me is, and again, I probably should have given a better background. So Ben Johnson, for those younger who don't know, wins the 100 in at the Seoul Olympics, runs 9.79. At the time, the 100 is essentially like winning the world's heavyweight championship. I mean, it's still very, very big, obviously, in the post Usain Bolt world. But at that time, like, if you were the world's fastest man or woman, I mean, you had some significant acclaim. Obviously, eventually there's testing. The Seoul Olympics administrators, doping, declare Ben Johnson, declare him to have done steroids. They take the gold medal away. That whole race, very famously, if you watch this documentary, has issues with almost every runner. And so it was a massive, massive story, particularly a massive story in Canada, of course, because we're talking about a historic gold medal in theory before, obviously, it's taken away from Ben. So, Mary, you covered this event, correct? You were a sports reporter covering this. You then covered, obviously, sort of the aftermath of this. So it's an interesting challenge to me in that you're in some ways re-reporting your own story and then adding like other source material from it. So the challenge of this book is kind of interesting to me. So how did you approach this, given that you're not like some, you know, you're not a historian just sort of attacking a new story that you're not part of? Because in this case, you actually covered this story when it was going on.
Right. Well, I suppose in the early stages, covering it meant we didn't do a very good job as media covering it at all, because later on, obviously going back into, you know, how do I go back at it now, decades later, and how do I sort of, you know, redeem myself as a journalist, but doing a proper job much later on. So you do what you do in a lot of cases when you're doing an investigation. You go back, what are the documents I get my hands on? So I was able to go back into the IOC and ask them about, you know, items from 88. Have you kept anything? Do the logs exist? What do you have? And so I dealt with the IOC quite a bit. And a lot of the material from 88 had been destroyed. But because Canada had a royal commission to look into what happened to Ben Johnson and the circumstances surrounding Seoul, there were some exhibits, in our National Archives. So I was able to go through National Archives, Ben's records, anything else I could find, newspaper records, and there was a trail there. And a lot of people were very good about being interviewed again. So that's, you know, it's that cold case approach. You go back at what you've had, then start asking questions about things that you can't get hold of as well. And that would be, you know, it's a little, you know, sort of, I don't know, esoteric is the right word. But one thing we did learn, the drug test in Seoul was a drug test and supporting documents. For some reason, the Canadian team defending Ben at Seoul, their strategy was to not look at the evidence. They didn't even look at all this documentation. So that was curious. And so when I got a hold of it in 2018, I saw that this was a document that was, you know, sort of replete with unsigned handwritten alterations, and an athlete's code had been, you know, scratched out and a new one handwritten in, all kinds of things that I thought could have been challenged as material, as a way to maybe, you know, as a last ditch effort to get Ben to keep his medal. If he said, held up this, you know, this doping document, say, what the heck is this? How can you, this be a professional document? You're scratching out things and writing all over it, you know? So that was something that really stuck with me, is Ben not getting due process in that moment.
What does Ben say about this now? Where does he sit in terms of how he thinks this should have been adjudicated?
Well, he feels that it was a rush to judgment, that he was singled out by the IOC, that there were a lot of preconceived notions about his musculature. A lot of people said the whites of his eyes were, you know, yellow because he was using, you know, so many steroids. He felt that he was set up to fail because by that point, he'd been using anabolic steroids rather sophisticatedly for about 8 years. He said, there's no way I would have tested positive. You know, we stopped about 3 weeks before Seoul. My clearance time was always really good. We always erred on the side of caution. And at that point, he thought he was using a different steroid that they caught him for. He thought he was using something that was, you know, undetectable to testers. But, you know, regardless, he felt that there's no way he should have been, picked out like that. And as it turns out, he was the only athlete in the track and field portion of those Seoul Olympics to test positive. The only athlete.
Wow. Yeah. Is his contention that essentially everyone else was doing this to get a competitive advantage? I was doing it, but I was singled out. And thus that's the unfairness here.
Exactly. Because he's, you know, this was the 1980s. So it, you know, it's not the way it is now, but back in the 1980s, they only tested on competition day. So what that means is they were free to use it during training periods. There wasn't really any random testing. So it was the Wild West of doping. He was, you know, competing in a sport where it was rampant. And as you alluded to earlier, at the end of the day, six of those eight finalists in that Seoul final ended up having some kind of, link directly or indirectly to sanctions to do with doping.
Yeah, the race is sort of informally known as the dirtiest race of all time, right? That's sort of a colloquially, whether it should be even framed as that is kind of an interesting discussion because of, like you just said, the time that it existed, maybe dirty isn't even the right framework of this because everyone was doing it. It was sort of just a race of its time. One of the things that I appreciated you doing, and I think this is very hard reporting and quite frankly, something that I don't think I could pull off as well as you did, is you had to learn about the sports drug culture of the time. And you went back, obviously, and you found a lot of the nomenclature of those Olympics. Did you have to like sort of educate yourself on the steroids of the time, how the steroids of the time were tested? And then I would imagine, I mean, obviously I don't have to imagine, obviously. So however they do this in 2024, right, must be so different in terms of testing than they did back during the race that Ben Johnson ran in Seoul.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I had to go back and reread everything. And I, you know, read all the testimony and the report from the Dublin Inquiry, and old newspaper archives were just magic. They were just so good to, you know, go over all this stuff because they brought in experts too, international experts, IOC experts. So, you know, learning all that from back then, and it really did seem like it was, compared to today, it was a very primitive way of, you know, trying to sample the population to see who's cheating out there in an effort to try to keep it level. But we also found out too that there was a lot of, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know, don't go to this test in Switzerland or this race in Switzerland because you might be tested. So there was a lot of that going on back then, maybe still happening today. But when you fast forward now we have the World Anti-Doping Agency, purportedly an independent agency with way more sophistication, efficiencies. And now athletes had something that wouldn't have been dreamt of in the 80s, that biological passport, where they can actually sort of, you know, look at your endocrine system over time. I'm not sure if that's progress or if that's a really sadder state of affairs. So you have to actually, you know, dig into somebody's cellular structure to see, are you cheating or not?
Ben Johnson's 62 years old now. How much does he think about this? Clearing his name is the right. Like, is he concerned about legacy still, or has he sort of moved on at 62?
No, he has not moved on. He's moved on some aspects of his life. You know, he's built a career as a personal trainer and a coach. He's banned for life, so he can't actually be at track meets and be part of the world circuit. But he's doing this on his own. However, you asked how often does he think of this? I think he thinks of it almost every day, because there's a bitterness there, and a resentment. And the sort of historical unfairness of it all that has just been left to lie dormant in his mind, that it's never really been addressed and that he's been cast aside. And he still is fighting. He's still resilient and open to the idea of trying to clear his name, even if it's something along the lines of, he wasn't the only one doing it at the time in that race. I don't know if he'll ever be able to prove that, but he's really kind of motivated to have at least people understand better what was happening in that time at that race, and that he felt that he's been railroaded.
Has he read the book?
I think he is getting through it. Yes.
Okay. All right. So maybe you'll learn what he thinks of the book at some point. Maybe. Right.
He's a pretty honest guy. Yeah, but yeah. I think he's seen enough of it now to think that he's quite happy with the investigation that went into it.
You talk in the book how he sort of turned his life around in the 2000s. It's sort of like, he's sort of living very fast at a certain point and maybe sort of not as much now. You just mentioned he sort of serves as a personal trainer. One of the things that I have seen, I'm sure you have seen as well, and this really happens certainly in the United States, is athletes who have been celebrity, whether they are beloved or whether they were, kicked out of their sport, where they have notoriety, they can trade on that name and make money off of that. I don't know anything about Ben Johnson, but is he someone who's done like the card show circuit or the Comic-Con circuit? Because I'm not saying it is the equivalent, but Pete Rose has made millions of dollars basically on being Pete Rose.
Right. No, the short answer is no. But up here in Canada, he did do an infamous commercial for a sports drink called Cheetah Power Surge.
Oh,
so
wow.
He got and the tagline was the host asked him, Ben, when you run, do you cheetah? And Ben says, yes, I cheetah all the time, and holds up his can of the fancy energy drink. And that really sort of divided the country because they went, oh my God, what are you doing? Are you just making a fool of yourself? Why? And Ben's answer is, well, this guy approached me. His name is Frank D'Angelo. And, I made $12,500 on the day. I could use, you don't have to tell me how I can act and behave. And he got a payday out of it.
If I was Ben's agent, I'm advising him, you're not doing that unless there's a half million, a million ducks, not 12.5. I know the times were different. One of the... to me, and again, we've talked about this a little bit because I knew you were doing this book, and it's such an interesting topic. But the marketing and the commercial sell is not easy. It's not easy to try to sell a book about somebody whose sort of sporting accomplishment happened 36 years ago, just like philosophically, whether they're famous or not. Then you have the other notion of, people feel in Canada a certain way about Ben Johnson, either positively or negatively. So you sort of have to navigate that. And then lastly, there are millions of Canadians who were not born when Ben Johnson ran his race. So, these are not the things they necessarily teach you in journalism school, but how did your publishing company, how'd you want to sort of approach getting the word out on this?
Well, you've hit on all the hot buttons there. Like Ben is a very polarizing figure in sport. There are some people who are sympathetic to him since we've learned a lot more about how pervasive doping is. And there's some people who say, this guy's a cheater. Good God, what good is this doing? There's really kind of no gray area with this. And there are a lot of athletes out there who compete clean. And, I just sort of shopped the book around a little bit. And the short story is I couldn't get an agent, and, the publishing world was kind of like, it's old news. But we did have one guy who said, I'd read that book. And quite frankly, I really wasn't sure. And I was worried that, will anybody buy it? Will they care? Because of all the things you've mentioned and because of this polarizing nature of this historical sports figure. So, and I also didn't want to be seen as crusading for him, if you know what I mean. I just wanted roll that ball, straight down the lane and just let people, you make up your own decision. But I mean, here's what you need to know about this incredible story. So I was like, I hope people, you know, can see it for what it is and can understand it. And I think they're responding like, yeah, that's a really interesting story. And if there's some, you know, injustice that was done, or he was denied or deprived of due process, let's hear more about that. So I think that has been an appeal. And maybe in some ways people had underestimated, the appeal for Ben Johnson, because they seem to be interested in him now again.
Can you tell my listeners, this is just fascinating that these two figures came together, the how Ben Johnson came to interact with Diego Maradona?
Well, I mean, Ben has made millions and lost millions. And he was on one of those downslides after that second test that he'd banned for life, and really thinking about, oh my God, which way is my life going to go? And Diego Maradona's agent phoned out of the blue and said, hey, would you be interested in training Maradona, who was battling his own demons with substance abuse and trying to get back into the world of international football / soccer. And Ben said yes. So it was as easy as that. But Maradona came to Toronto to work out at York University, where Ben had had worked out. So, but it's not as weird as you might think, because they were celebrities at the same time in the 80s. Like, Maradona was huge, right? But Ben Johnson was also enormous because of that rivalry with Carl Lewis. So these were all sort of contemporaries, and they knew, well, we both got some baggage, so, you know, let's try to work it out. So, you know, it sounds like Ben got him on the right road for a little while. And unfortunately, you know, Maradona tested positive again later that fall, and that was the end of his career.
I still, though, I must, it is stunning to me, if you were walking around York University and you see Ben Johnson and Diego Maradona, like, training, your head, especially if you were like a world soccer fan, world football fan, your head would spin basically at that kind of sighting.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The last one I want to ask you about, and again, I'm sure you and / your publisher and PR people, if they haven't done this, you should absolutely do it. But it strikes me that with the Olympics coming up this summer, CBC, of course, covers the Olympics in Canada, NBC / Peacock covers in the United States. Anybody listening to this podcast in the US would know that. But Mary, it does strike me that, like, this would really be a good story for the CBC in terms of their, like, sort of Olympic previews or during track and field, whatever. I mean, you know, it's not a perfect round number, 40th anniversary or whatever, people like that. But, like, there's now a book out on Ben Johnson. It's an interesting book. He's still one of the most prominent figures in the history of the Olympics for Canada. And Canada obviously has a great track and field tradition. You know, I don't know how Andre de Grasse will do in this Olympics, but, you know, that's a guy who was contending for world's fastest crown at one point. Have you heard from the CBC, or will you pitch the CBC? I mean, if nothing else, I feel like they should try to talk to Ben. Maybe Ben won't talk to them, but they should make the attempt, I would think.
No, I think they're probably going to talk to him for, something coming up shortly. But whether it's going to be a longer term interest in anything, I'm not sure. But I still think, because the book came out in 2024, there is some cachet there for an Olympics. Even if it's always around, doping, we still see the same doping issues in this year. People are still testing positive. And I will just say, you know, what has changed since 1988? Well, not much. But, you know, Ben was held up as the poster boy for don't do this. The war on doping is over, because we've caught and jailed the biggest, star in our galaxy. But that was really exploited for a long time, because people are not only just testing positive, they're still using the same stuff. People are still using anabolic steroids. So, you know, whatever, the battle cry was in 88, it's still a battle cry in 2024.
Yeah. That's my last one I wanted to ask you as I let you go. How do you think this story would have played in 2024? In some ways it would have been magnified, because social media, we live in now a 24/7 world. At the same time, there's a lot more cynicism out there. And there's also a lot more people who would, I think, just not see this as such a big scandal. Whether it's, you know, Alex Rodriguez or Barry Bonds and stuff, like in some ways, the sporting public is sort of, there are many people who believe, like, so what that these guys did this? Like, you know, if everybody was doing it, like, then it just becomes about like medicine and technology. So I'm curious if this, let's say this happened, an equivalent happened in Paris. How do you think it plays out?
I'd say people would just go, oops, you know, as opposed to, oh my God, you know, the sky is falling. It's just like, you know, so many people have fallen in so many sports, you know, including Lance Armstrong.
Yeah.
So I would agree with you that there's almost an ennui about the whole thing. Say, oh my God, how did he screw up? But oops, he'll be back, because a lot of them do come back now.
Yeah. And if infamy is the right word, infamy sells much differently in 2024 than it would have in 1988. We're just in a different time and a different culture. I mean, you know, my God, look at who's led some of the nation's biggest countries in the world. So we're in a different period here. Mary Ormsby is the author of World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. You can pick this up anywhere, Amazon, Goodreads. Is that correct, Mary? Where your local Canadian bookstores. Is it in the States in bookstores?
Barnes and Noble, I believe, and perhaps Target or Target, as it's known.
Wow, look at that. All right. So again, for anybody, this is a really, really interesting story. And again, there are certainly, I know, people who listen to this podcast who are really into the Olympics. And again, this is sort of one of the most remarkable Olympic stories in the last 50 years. Mary, I wish you the best of luck with this book. By the way, before Mary goes, let me just point this out. Mary Ormsby is not only a phenomenal writer and reporter, but played volleyball at Ohio State University at a time when very, very few Canadians were being recruited to play college sports at the highest level in the States. So, Mary, now you have seen the Big Ten explode. I mean, the Caitlin Clarkization of the world is taking off. So you are a real pioneer here, and you must be, nothing else, pretty thrilled to see. I mean, you played women's sports in the early 80s. It's like a different planet. You must be thrilled now to see like where, I mean, Caitlin Clark just signed a $20 million shoe deal. Like you must be thrilled to see where this stuff is now.
I thought we were pretty hot stuff back in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, because, you know, Title IX was in and, you know, woohoo. And it was great back then. But just to see this progress, it's mind blowing and it's about time. And I'll just say, I don't take my Ohio State varsity ring off ever. Best 4 years of my life. Go Bucks. Nice. And my daughter is down at San Diego State University playing lacrosse. So there's just a wonderful sort of circular thing about all of this. And I love sports so much, and that women are being promoted. And someone like you, Richard, who, you know, in their corner and say, you got to watch these women play. They're phenomenal athletes. It just makes my heart grow huge.
First of all, I love the fact that your daughter saw that you went to Columbus, Ohio, laughed at this and said, I'm going to San Diego State. There's no chance I'm dealing with a Midwest United States.
The weather, I know.
God bless her. She's an Aztec. Mary, thank you so much, and I wish you the best of luck with
thank
this
you,
book.
Richard.
Thank you for coming on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Mary Ormsby for an interesting interview, and I hope that book does really, really well. I got to know Mary a little bit once we moved to Toronto. She's an awesome person and super talent. If you like this kind of stuff, head to the archives. There should be a ton of stuff for you. You know, if you wanted the sort of hardcore, heavy, nerdy media stuff, Andrew Marchand, James Andrew Miller were on this podcast very recently to talk about all the things going on in the sports media. If you're into the behind the scenes of how data gets used by these sports media companies, ESPN data strategist Flora Kelly was on this podcast. We've obviously done a ton of stuff on Caitlin Clark. You can check that out. Individual guests, Andrea Carter was on this podcast not too long ago. Becky Lynch, Pablo Torre, and Peter King and Sue Bird, and the list goes on and on. Best way for this podcast to continue, leave us a 5-star review and a nice note. That's how things continue to roll. I want to thank Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work. Thanks to everybody at Odyssey for their support. And thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.